I was born Beatrice Ann Cretney in Sterlington, Louisiana on August 11, 1928. After graduation from University of Wisconsin in chemical engineering, my father went to Sterlington, Louisiana to work for a Thermatomic Carbon Company at the invitation of Clark Boardman, also a University of Wisconsin engineering graduate. Thermatomic manufactured commercial carbon used to strengthen rubber for use in making automobile tires, etc. After their marriage in October of 1923, my mother, Beatrice Shear Cretney, joined him in Sterlington. Mother and dad, as students at the university in Madison, had met there. My mother graduated in 1923. I'm not sure of her major. It may have been English. Her only paying job was in a library. My mother's home was Vienna in Virginia, near Washington, D.C., where her father worked as a mycologist for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. She was sent to Madison to attend university because her older brother, Sherwood Shear, was working on a graduate degree there, and it was thought he could keep an eye on her. My dad's family was living in Madison at that time, having moved there from Ridgeway, Wisconsin, where he was born. My grandfather, Thomas Cretney, was a building contractor and inventor who also served one term as a Wisconsin state representative. I was one of three children, having an older brother, Wesley, and a younger sister, Elizabeth. Sterlington was a small community of a few thousand, composed mostly of laboring persons employed by the local industries. When Wesley and I entered elementary school there, we were way ahead of many of the other students educationally due to the unusual advantage of having two university-educated parents. Wesley was promoted directly from second grade to fourth because he was so advanced. When I was nine, we moved from Sterlington to nearby Monroe, which then had a population of over 10,000. While we were growing up, whenever anyone was making plans to attend university, it was usually LSU. My father made it clear to us that LSU was not in the cards for us, that we were headed for the University of Wisconsin. My brother Wesley graduated from high school at 16, and because it was 1943 and World War II was in full swing, my dad thought it would be to Wesley's advantage to get as much education as possible before he became eligible for the draft. So at 16 years, he was sent off to Madison to study engineering. There he was put right into an accelerated program designed for Navy V-12s. Due to several health problems, he was not able to keep up with the accelerated program, and after 2 years, he had to withdraw. After a term in the Navy, he completed his engineering degree at Louisiana Tech. When I graduated from high school in 1945, I applied to the University of Wisconsin, but was turned down because the GIs were coming back from war and there were limited spaces for out-of-state students. My dad suggested that I attend business school for a year while I waited for the situation to improve, something that proved an advantage to me for the rest of my life. In 1946, when I applied again, the situation had not improved, and it was suggested that I attend a local college or university and apply later with advanced standing. So in 1946, I enrolled at Louisiana Tech in Ruston. After 2 years at Tech, I was accepted at the university as a transfer student. I don't know what kind of reputation the University of Wisconsin had at that time, but my dad felt it was the only alternative. There weren't any other schools considered, and I always knew that Louisiana Tech was only a step along the way. Wisconsin was the ultimate goal. My parents provided almost all of the finances for my years at the university. I had no scholarship aid, and my part-time job only provided help with spending money. My part-time job was as a desk clerk at the Madison Free Library. I don't recall at all what I was paid. I worked a couple of evenings a week and sometimes on Saturday, shelving books and checking them in and out. Aunt Emery accepted residence only upon recommendation, but my mother had a friend in Monroe whose daughter was living at Aunt Emery, and she recommended me. I don't even remember her name. Aunt Emery was located on Langdon Street and was very handy to that side of the campus, the Union, the library, etc. But of course we had to climb up and or over the dreaded Bascom Hill for most of our classes. I remember looking out the window on cold winter days and seeing taxis waiting for some of the wealthier and less adventurous girls to drive them to class. I would never have considered such an extravagance. However, I admit to some dismay when the wind off the lake hit as I crossed Park Street toward the hill on a cold winter day. There were many comments on the calf size of girls developed by many trips up and down Bascom Hill. There were always Rube Goldberg type ideas of how to eliminate the necessity of climbing Bascom Hill. As far as I know, there are as yet no elevators or escalators that eliminate the necessity for climbing Bascom Hill. The fire at Aunt Emery occurred in October 1949, my senior year, and my room was on the fifth or top floor. When the fire began, I was on my way home on State Street when people began running past me, and when I turned the corner, I saw Aunt Emery was on fire. Those of us on the top floor suffered the most damage from smoke and water and were out until we returned from Christmas vacation. The first night, everyone had to arrange emergency housing, and I spent the night with friends who had an apartment nearby. However, I was unable to sleep very much because I was keyed up from the fire. I had at least one midterm exam the next day, and with hardly any sleep due to excitement and overstimulation, some of us got the professor to agree to let us take the exam a few days later. Since dinner was already cooked when the fire broke out, we all went down to the basement and ate, even though there was water on the floor. President and Mrs. Fred took a couple of girls for overnight. The next day, all fifth floor residents were assigned to temporary housing until the rooms could be repaired. Along with five friends, I was assigned a place at a sorority house on Langdon Street where they had empty beds. We continued to take our meals at Aunt Emery. My roommate, Marge Anderson, lived somewhere else. I don't remember where. My dad happened to be in Chicago on business at the time, and he came to Madison and helped me move my things from Aunt Emery to the sorority house. Our room at Aunt Emery was on the front of the building, and the fire was right above us, so we had lots of smoke and water damage. We had left our closet open, and many of the sleeves on the door side had singe marks on them. Everything had to be cleaned to get rid of the smoke smell. We had a stack of books piled on the carpeted floor, and the water soaked right up through the whole pile, and they had to be thrown out. My parents had bought a new set of luggage for my trip to Madison, and it all went up in smoke a little over a year later. They had to send me another set to use on my trip home for Christmas. There were strict rules at Aunt Emery compared to today's standards, and of course there were always those who got excitement from trying to get around the rules. As I remember, our weeknight hours were 11 p.m. and weekends 12 p.m. and on prom night 1 a.m. was closing time. People who came in late were sentenced to stay in and give up a weekend night. There was someone in charge called Almy, I think she was the assistant manager, and a grandmotherly person affectionately called Aunt Millie, who operated the switchboard and distributed mail at the front desk. She knew all the girls. The janitor was a German man named Peter Stork, whom we called Storky. On special occasions, he would come to the dining room and play the concertina and sing for us. It was one big happy family. We had our meals in the basement dining room. For breakfast on weekends, we were allowed to come in our pajamas and file through the kitchen and pick up our breakfast. Although they weren't assigned, most people had regular tables and someone would go down early and hold places for their friends. The meals were served family style. There were 12 people at each table, and whoever sat at either end of the table was expected to serve plates for themselves and 5 others. I thought the food was excellent, but I remember one Friday evening when most of the girls walked out in protest when they served shrimp creole. I stayed and ate heartily, and we never had shrimp creole again. Silly girls. Being from Louisiana, shrimp was a familiar part of my diet, but apparently not for Wisconsin girls. My experience there was a pleasant one, and I still correspond with many of the friends I made there. Before I enrolled at the university, I had decided to major in sociology. I had never heard of it before I started reading course descriptions in anticipation of going to university. I thought I would major in home ec, but my father ruled that out as insignificant. Sociology interested me, and I was never sorry that I chose it. One of the overriding influences at the university when I was there was the presence of so many World War II vets, many of them married with children. Professor Harlow, an anthropologist known as the Monkey Man because of his world-famous primate lab, was one of my professors. Many of the classes were huge lectures, including as many as 500 students. There was a large lecture hall in Bascom Hall where I took beginning psychology and sociology, and it held about 500 students. The temporaries were much in use, and T-16 held several hundred. It was over on the other side of Bascom Hill from Ann Emery, and I dreaded 7:45 classes there. I took social disorganization there, and we each had assigned seats for purposes of checking attendance. People commonly bribed someone to sit in their seat so as not to be marked absent. Once, when a lecture by a doctor from the hospital on sexual aberrations was announced, we arrived to find our regular seats filled by thrill seekers. There were people standing all around the sides of the room for that lecture. No need to check attendance. There was one professor that I thought was a real jerk. I can't remember his name, but he was very rude, and he would scuffle up to the podium in the lecture theater in Bascom Hall, and if it didn't get quiet at once, he'd bellow, "Shut up!" into the microphone. We likened him to a chimpanzee because of his stooped posture and because he was an anthropology professor. I took a class in sketching that I enjoyed. It was exciting to have nude models. I also took economics from Wild Bill Kekover. Many girls were accustomed to knitting in classes, myself included, and Kekover banned knitting in his lectures, but the lecture theater and music hall was so large that we could sit in the back and knit without fear of detection. We were a little nervous when we dropped a metal needle and it made a noise, but he never seemed to notice. He was a colorful character. I enjoyed a class in creative writing, and I wrote a children's story about the birth of Prince Charles called The Fat Little Stork. The professor offered to help me get it published if I rewrote the ending, but I never did. I still have a copy that some art major friends illustrated for me. I never had a class from Miss White, an English professor, but she was a campus character with white hair who always wore purple. She had been at the university since my mother was there. The size of classes was very intimidating at Wisconsin, and when I was a senior, I realized I didn't know a single professor well enough to ask for a recommendation. My advisor was Professor Clenard, and he was so offhand about checking my class schedule that I really worried that I might not have met all the requirements for my degree. We heard some horror stories. On graduation day, we were given sheets in our graduation folders telling us what room to report to in Bascom Hall to collect our diploma. I remember climbing the hill and wondering if there'd be a diploma with my name on it. Much to my relief, there was one. Maybe Mr. Clenard was paying more attention than I thought. I thought the quality of instruction was good in general. I didn't belong to any clubs or organizations aside from Press House. It is not easy to get into university life when you're a transfer student with only 2 years to go. I was warmly welcomed there and felt at home there after a very short time. Press House was located on the corner of State and Murray, which was a good location if you lived at Ann Emory or a Greek organization, but not so handy for people in university dorms. Practically all my social life revolved around events at Press House. Besides organized parties, etc., there were lots of informal picnics organized at one of the local parks or picnic point. Over the Easter vacation, Press House sponsored a survey trip to Chicago. We went by bus to Chicago and spent one night at the YMCA Hotel and visited Hull House, museums, churches, etc. It was a lot of fun. I went for 2 years. I have many fond memories of singing around the campfire beside a lake. I also learned to ice skate on Lake Mendota. As a Louisiana girl, my only association with ice skating was seeing Sonya Henie in the movies. It was not easy to learn at 20 years old, but I persevered. I was then able to go to skating parties sponsored by Press House. I also had my first experience with tobogganing at a Press House party. It was pretty breathtaking. Another interest I developed at Press House was folk and square dancing. I took a course offered by the City of Madison on square dance calling and enjoyed conducting square dances. On dates, we mostly went to movies if there wasn't a party at Press House. There were very cheap movies shown at the Union, for 25 cents, I believe. Often they were foreign films. There were square folk dances at the Union and, of course, the Rat. One thing I remember about the Rat was Teresa Brewer singing Music, Music, Music on the jukebox. I heard that it was played so much they had to replace the record. Besides social activities at Press House, I served on a student board of deacons and sang in the choir. The organist director, Miriam Belleville, was a very accomplished musician and conducted a wonderful choir program. The Press House choirs were known for their excellence. The ministers were Doc Lauer and Jack Collins. There was a spiritual resurgence following the end of World War II, and the late 40s and 50s were probably the heyday of Press House. It was a real swinging place. It was an experimental project where it was not only a student center, but it was chartered as a regular Presbyterian church with all the officers as students, the same officers as any other Presbyterian church. There were boards of trustees, deacons, and elders elected from the student members. It was an exciting experiment and one that succeeded very well. It was exciting to be a part of it. The Press House building now houses the MCC, Madison Campus Ministry. There was never any liquor at Press House parties, but there was lots of beer at dorm and fraternity parties. There were not supposed to be hard liquor at those parties, but there were always instances of it being sneaked in. I always remember green beer at the pub on St. Patrick's Day. It was at the University of Wisconsin where I first encountered pizza. Until then, the only Italian food I had encountered was spaghetti. I think pizza was just coming into vogue. I don't remember any negative feelings against smoking, and I wasn't aware of any experimenting with drugs. I was not involved in politics. I remember Harry Truman came to speak on the campus while I was there, but I don't remember what he said. The big social concern seemed to be around the future of nuclear weapons. There was much concern that they never be used again. Frieda Urey, daughter of Harold Urey, who worked on the Manhattan Project, was active at Press House when I was there. I remember reading the Cardinal. One of my friends, Rita Dorman, was a journalism major and wrote for the Cardinal. One of my favorite memories is of a picture painted on one of the Quonset huts on the green near the historical library, where of a girl wearing only underpants with her bust concealed by a newspaper, and over or under it was written, "The Cardinal covers everything." As to the quality of what I read, I can't really comment. It seemed satisfactory to me. I don't know what I had to compare it to. When I arrived at the university, the Goodbye Harry campaign was in full swing. At every football game, students were waving signs saying Goodbye Harry. Harry Stuhldreher was coach, and he was soon out. I don't remember how the team was doing, but I suspect not very well. However, the university marching band, under the leadership of Mr. Dvorak, was outstanding and a real treat to watch. The halftime shows were wonderful. There was always some drinking at games, mostly by alumni, or at least as much as by students, and the students were not rowdy. I attended basketball games at the field house, but I don't remember how well we were doing. The big excitement was Don Gehrman and the anticipated 4-minute mile. I remember sitting in the armory on Saturday afternoons in the winter and watching Don run. He had an interesting style of running. It looked so easy and laid back, but at the end he'd give a kick and speed to the end. I really wished he'd be the one to break the 4-minute mile, but it was not to be. Someone else beat him to it. I'll never forget watching him run and how exciting it was. There were many international students around, and I was not aware of discrimination against them. There were black students too, but I must admit that few of them chose to associate with Presshouse. The only discrimination I was aware of was regarding Jews. The Jewish students from the East, New York, New Jersey, etc., were considered to be loud and pushy. I discovered Ann Emory was a closed dorm when they inadvertently admitted a Jewish girl and were very apologetic for it. I didn't care. I don't remember any gender discrimination, but it may have been there. I don't remember the deans of men and women. They certainly didn't play any part in my university experience. The only reason I knew President Fred was because he was a colleague of my grandfather's. My grandfather, Cornelius L. Shear, was a botanist and had met Dr. Fred professionally, and he took it upon himself to write to him and tell him I was there and ask him to look out for me. I was quite surprised to receive a call from the president's office asking me to come in for a visit. I didn't get to talk to President Fred personally. I was interviewed by an assistant who asked how I was doing and if I needed anything. I think Grandfather was disappointed that President Fred didn't tend to me personally. When I graduated from the University of Wisconsin, my goal was to work with children through the YWCA or Girl Scouts or in the Presbyterian Church. Upon graduation, I wanted to remain in Madison another year, so I secured a position as a secretary in the University Commerce Department at the Bureau of Business Research and Service, a position I would not have qualified for had I not had that year of business school after high school. My business skills have been a valued bonus throughout my life, and I would not have had them if I had not been marking time waiting to get into the University of Wisconsin. After a year, I was ready to move on. Before I went to Madison, my plan had been to attend Assemblies Training School in Richmond, Virginia, to train as a religious education worker. However, at Presshouse, Doc Lauer and Jack Collins, both alumni of Union Seminary in New York City, convinced me that that would be a much better place. So I was off to New York City, where Union Theological Seminary and Columbia University offered a 1-year joint degree for an MA in religious education. Following that, I worked 1 year for a Presbyterian church in Charlotte, North Carolina. Then Jack Collins from Presshouse asked me to come and work with him as financial secretary, a job for which I was uniquely qualified because I had training in both business skills and religious education. I was thrilled at the prospect of returning to Madison. Little did I know that fate had another surprise in store for me. The fall of 1951, when I left for New York City, my future husband, Roger Meitzer, arrived at the University of Wisconsin from Fargo, North Dakota, to work on a PhD in biochemistry under Harry Steenbach, who was about to be the first to patent the process for adding vitamin D to milk. When I returned to Madison in the fall of 1953, Roger was in the final year of work toward his PhD. In August of 1954, we were married in Monroe, Louisiana. That fall, my younger sister, Elizabeth, transferred from Louisiana Tech to the University of Wisconsin and lived at Ann Emory Hall. She was a music major. Roger received his PhD in 1954, but he continued to work for Dr. Steenbach on a postdoctoral fellowship for another year, and I continued to work for Presshouse. We lived in an older house right behind Press House on Murray Street, which is now a parking lot. The house was owned by Press House at that time. In 1955, we moved to Chicago, where Roger worked as a research lab at Northwestern University Medical School. In October 1955, we had our first child. My sister Elizabeth graduated from the university in 1956 and went to teach music in the schools in Fenimore, Wisconsin. There she met her husband, David Brandemill, a dairy farmer. Their four children have all attended the university at Madison. The two boys graduated in engineering. One girl earned an MA in speech therapy and audiology, and the younger daughter is just completing a degree in art. David Brandemill now serves as a state representative from Fenimore in Madison. We are the parents of seven children, and since we moved to Canada in 1967, we were not able to afford to continue the tradition and educate our children at the University of Wisconsin. However, we have one son who's a chemistry professor with a PhD, one who's a clergyman, and a daughter who's a lawyer. Three out of seven with postgraduate degrees is not bad. I've always felt that I was extremely fortunate to have had the benefit of an education at the University of Wisconsin. I felt it was progressive and encouraged independent thinking, and I'm sure it has colored and enriched my entire approach to life. It was not the custom in my era for mothers to work outside the home if the husband's income was adequate, so I never worked outside the home for pay after we started our family. However, through the years, I have worked for the church in various volunteer capacities, and I continue to do so. I have gotten great enjoyment out of teaching Sunday school, conducting youth camps, and leading classes in parenting education. For me, Madison was a magical place with its lakes and parks and picnic point. When we visit Madison, we go to the university bookstore, press house, and the Union Terrace. Ann Emery is divided into apartments now, so it's not the same. Some of my miscellaneous memories are of the carillon playing, the ski jump from Bascom Hill onto the lake, which has since been demolished, skating, sailing, and canoeing on Lake Mendota, and ski classes on Bascom Hill. I still enjoy singing Varsity and If You Want to Be a Badger. And let's not forget Skyrockets. That's a long tradition because I remember my parents demonstrating that for me before I left home. My days in Madison were the most exciting of my life. When we go back, the campus is quite changed, but I hope that young people are still getting the quality education today that I believe I received 45 years ago.